Did you get it all done? Chapter 12 and 13. Now I'm going to give you the last of the reading assignment, the last half of chapter 13 of the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness. We've been doing this in preparation for our special Sabbath coming up next Sabbath, the great musical presentation and celebration of the resurrection of Jesus. So your reading assignment for next week is the last half of that chapter of the triumph in the wilderness. As we make preparation for this occasion, have I missed something? The children are all here ready to sing. Pardon me? It'll be at the end. Okay, I saw them all here. Well, I'm glad you're right here in front. But I thought maybe they were going to sing twice and I was getting in their way. Not doing that, huh? Okay, something to look forward to at the close of the service. So do your reading assignment. Look forward to the celebration Sabbath. And it's an interesting thing as we think about this. A celebration, it's really a drastic and tragic story. The Passion Week begins Sunday. It was the triumphal entry, Palm Sunday, as it is called. And the days of the week are the events of that Passion Week. And we come to next Sabbath. Jesus rests in the tomb and is raised. And we have been preparing for that now for 3 weeks as we have been looking at the temptations in the wilderness. There was nothing obviously evil in the temptations in the wilderness. Did you ever think of that? There was nothing obviously evil. If they were obviously evil, they wouldn't have been temptations. Remember that. If they were obviously evil, they wouldn't be temptations. They could all be rationalized as good things to do. The first temptation was to provide for physical needs. Anything wrong with that? No, that's a good thing to do. The second temptation was to appeal, pardon me, the second temptation was, got lost my spot here because I left something out. Let me go back. Got all mixed up when I saw the kids here. So I got to get a rewind in my head. Even as in the Garden of Eden, the appeal was to appetite, but that was the excuse, not the reason. The issue was trust in God. The second temptation was to demonstrate faith. Now, surely there's nothing wrong with demonstrating faith. That's a good thing to do. But that was not the real issue. The real issue was the difference in faith lived or faith demonstrated by personal gain. Faith demonstrated as personal gain is not faith at all, but is rather presumption. The third temptation is a new way to save the world. Okay, there you go. Now, there can't be anything wrong with that, can there? A new way to save the world. A shortcut, if you please. After all, wasn't that what Jesus came to do? And if you could give him a shortcut, wouldn't that be a good idea? There was nothing obviously wrong with the temptations, because if they had been obviously wrong, they wouldn't be temptations. Yes, they could all be rationalized. But that's an interesting thing about that word, rationalized. That's the way it is with error. Error has to be rationalized. Truth does not need to be rationalized. Why? It's already rational. Truth does not need to be rationalized. Only error needs to be rationalized. Only error calls for rationalization. So if you find yourself rationalizing something, watch out. You know when you have to do that, it's the wrong direction. Thus we see with the sham of rationalization swept away that temptation is merely variations on a theme of breaking the relationship with God. The first questions Jesus' relation with God. The second dares him to prove the relationship with God. And the third seeks to compromise the relationship with God. Matthew, the fourth chapter, verses 8 to 11. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give to you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Jesus said to him, away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. In the third temptation, Satan no longer comes as a fake. Remember the first two temptations, he comes as an angel of light, supposedly commissioned from the throne of God. Third temptation, he doesn't bother with that anymore. He says, okay, you know it's me. I know it's you. Let's not play this silly little game anymore. Satan comes no longer as an angel of light, but still as a mighty angel, excelling in strength. Not a hideous monster in a red suit with cloven hooves and a spear for a tail. He is a beautiful specimen of angelic strength. Don't forget that. Now we have all this nonsense about what the devil supposedly looks like. He is an angel of strength. Twice he sought to trick Jesus unsuccessfully. Now he tries to con him, saying, if you want to buy this place back, I'll make you a deal you can't resist. You see, Satan never comprehended why anyone would be willing to suffer for anyone else. Satan never could conceive that any man would pass up an offer of power and glory and opt instead for pain and humiliation. He never understood that. But then he never understood what God wanted to do here in the first place anyway. It was over the creation of this world and God's plan to create man and woman in his own image that Satan first rebelled in heaven. And now he makes a foolish offer. I will give you this place, he says. He always hated it anyway. The only reason he wanted it was so someone else couldn't have it. He hated the people. He hated the flowers. He hated the song of the birds. He hated creation in general. And now he saw a chance to unload a lemon for a terrific price. I will show you a shortcut, he says. You need not make the arduous trek to the cross and to the tomb. You need not suffer rebuke and shame, anguish and privation. I know another way, a shortcut. And remember, after all, up to this point, with everyone of this human race, he had 100% success. And he sees Jesus as another man that he can con. He takes Jesus to a high mountain. An idea, by the way, which he borrowed from God. Curious, isn't it? He keeps borrowing God's ideas. God taking Moses to the promise on the high mountain to show Moses the promised land. Now he takes Jesus to a high mountain. And he offers the panoramic view of the glories and the beauties of the earth. He tries to dress it up. Beauty spans from horizon to horizon. There is no wilderness here. There is fruitful valleys. There are prosperous cities. There are peaceful kingdoms. Satan seeks to make the ugly marks of sin disappear, even as he does when he offers his alluring schemes to us. He has bungled his dominion in this crumbling world, and he would like to unload it. So he covers it with a glossy facade, and he puts it up for barter. I will show you a shortcut. Like a crooked used car dealer, he shoots it with a coat of cheap paint, puts sawdust in the crankcase to seal the leaks, gives it a cheap tune-up, but there is no quality in the work. And under this veneer of repair is a corroded and decaying carcass. And this corroded carcass called earth, Satan offers to the one that he stole it from, its rightful owner, who has come to do a complete overhaul. Satan always is offering a shortcut, a get-rich-quick scheme. But as so frequently happens, shortcuts turn into disasters, and get-rich-quick schemes become instant poverty programs instead. Satan seeks to defy the law of the harvest. God does not cause instant fruit to grow in the summer. Rather, each tree, through the warmth of the sun, the nutrition of the soil, the moisture of the rain, month by month, cell by cell, produces the fruit. Likewise, there is no instant sanctification. Day by day, through the warmth of God's grace, through the nurture of His Word, through the watering of the Holy Spirit, the Christian produces the fruits of love in the fragrance of truth. There is no shortcut. Don't be deluded. Jesus refuses the shortcut. He came to seek mankind as brothers and sisters. But all that Satan could offer in this deal was what he possessed. And all he possessed were slaves living in corruption. God did not create us to be in bondage, and He will not accept us in bondage. Anyone who insists on being in bondage will not be part of God's kingdom, for no forced service will be in the kingdom of God. Force and bondage are of another government, and those who feel forced or enslaved in their religion, or who seek to force and enslave others in their religion, are serving the wrong God. God is the God of free will. It is Satan who seeks to possess us and control our lives. You've heard the term possessed by an evil spirit. Satan possesses this earth only by fraud and deceit. It was from Adam that he wrestled possession, but Adam's dominion was under God. Thus, Satan is offering to Christ his own lowly position at the head of a corrupted world which he had stolen from someone else. Why would Jesus accept such an offer? Satan couldn't figure out why he wanted the earth anyway. He could not understand love. He thought Jesus might seek to avoid suffering, as he always would, in order to gain possession of the earth. But Jesus came not to strike a bargain for the purchase of slaves, but to win back the love of a family. Suppose for a moment, and I'll have to admit before I ask you this, this is a crazy request. Suppose for a moment that Satan could be trusted, that he really would keep his promise. Suppose that he really was sincere. Proposal that is ridiculous to think about, but I'm asking you to think about it. Suppose he really could be trusted. Suppose he really was sincere. The problem remains, no matter how sincere you are, if you're believing falsehood, you will experience disaster. Sincerity is not the issue. No matter what Satan promises, corrupt motives can only produce destruction. But note carefully the distinction between the plan of God and the plan of Satan. Both claim to seek the well-being and happiness of the individual, but one does so at the expense of all creation, while the other seeks happiness to the benefit of all creation. First is all for myself. The second is myself for all. Satan offers that which is not his to give. He does not have the collateral to back up his pledges. His is a bankrupt government. His currency is empty promises, and his capital is crumbling dreams. He offers us riches, pleasure, honor, happiness, if we will only acknowledge his supremacy. His mind is obsessed to the end that we surrender our position as sons and daughters of God to worship him. From the beginning, this has been the issue. He cannot stand for God to share his dominion with us, to call us his children, to be part of God's family. In morbid fear of losing his position, Satan has beguiled us out of our inheritance as sons and daughters of God. Now Satan deigns to bring into question the position of Jesus as the Son of God. Here they stand, a mighty angel, a weary man. And in answer to this challenge, divinity flashes through humanity as God gives the power of utterance to Jesus. And he says, Matthew, the 4th chapter, verse 10, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Satan writhes and twitches on the ground in rage and humiliation as he is forced to withdraw, for he cannot bear to stand in the presence of God. The power of love becomes an unbearable condemnation to the forces of wickedness, and evil angels flee lest they be consumed by righteousness. So you would like the evil angels to flee from you? Be filled with the righteousness of Christ. Even as water provides nourishment and life to plants and animals, in the contact with certain chemicals, it causes violent explosions. It is not the nature of the water that makes the difference. It is the nature of what it comes in contact with. So also, love and righteousness, which is a blessing to one, is destruction to another. It is the nature of the elements that makes the difference. Christ's victory in the wilderness was complete, even as Adam's failure in the garden was complete. Jesus gained the victory through faith in God and in his commitment to God's will. Matthew 4:11, then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. Jesus fell exhausted, as if dying. And suddenly he was surrounded by heavenly angels, ministering, serving, strengthening, feeding him. What a contrast. Even angels can tempt or serve. Even angels can corrupt or save. Which band of angels would you like to have around yourself? And from the strength of that ministry of the angels, Jesus set out to accomplish his mission. Was this the end of the battle? Was this the last of temptations? By no means. Again and again, Satan pressed in with the same old lines. Prove who you are. Save yourself. Compromise your principles. But the strength of overcoming grew and grew. And confidence in God remained. And victory was obtained, even as it may be for us. Each temptation resisted, each invitation rebuffed, provides greater strength to achieve the next through the power of God to win over and over again. It was when I was in the eighth grade, I became fascinated with the Olympics. The high jump was something I particularly was impressed with. And so I set up a standard which I could practice the high jump. Put up two posts, put another post across, stick across, and in the backyard I would run out and I would practice my high jump. Interesting thing happened. Day by day, by overcoming the height of the previous day, I got to the place, not where I ever entered the Olympics, but by jumping day by day, I achieved greater heights than I had the day before. And as we rely on the surrounding power of God and his angels to overcome temptation, we can overcome better and higher and stronger day by day. From a high mountain, Moses viewed the promised land. Desiring to go in, God told him no. Because of sin, you must first enter the portal of death. From a high mountain, Jesus viewed a promised land. And Satan suggested, "You don't need to die. I will give it to you. I have a shortcut." But Jesus said, "No. Because of sin, I must first enter the portal of the tomb and death." How often we view promised lands from high mountains in our minds. We view the heights of riches and of power and of pleasure. But joy and pleasure sought by trampling on those we have used to satisfy our own greed will only bring empty echoes of what might have been if we had shared. Riches of fraud are the deepest form of poverty, soul poverty. The power of oppression is the weakest kind of helplessness, for it seeks to dominate others, and in so doing, we lose our ability to rule our own spirit. The pleasures of lust are the most grievous of sorrows, bringing in their train disease, isolation, loneliness, and self-hatred. Though these may appear as lofty goals, these temptations are not heights of joy, but depths of anguish. Go instead with God to his high mountain. Let him show you his promised land. Let him teach you the riches of sharing. Let him teach you the power of service. Let him teach you the pleasure of pure fellowship. Here you will see that any enticement of sin which is surrendered in the Christian life is exchanged for true value in the promises of God. The shortcut may appear smooth and beautiful, while the path of God seems sometimes to lead to suffering, maybe even to the portal of a tomb. Yet Satan does not show you the chasm just over the hill on the shortcut. It is his desire for you to move smoothly along, accelerating down the pathway of the shortcut of self-gratification, till when you reach the brim, you can't turn back. God reveals the path of the Christian, sometimes through suffering and death. But he has trod the way before and willingly walked to the cross and the tomb that he might walk through out the other side and into the promised land. Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice, I will come into them and dine with them." Now he is willing to be with you. He knocks at the door. But interestingly enough, Satan also knocks on the door of the heart. But if Jesus is there and goes to the door, he says, "Get thee hence, Satan." Dine with Jesus. Send him to the door.